was very inspired just when Anne started talking. Is this on? Yes, good. When she started talking about the horse chestnut trees, and I wondered whether any of you have enjoyed the autumn colours this autumn. Hand up if you enjoy the autumn colours. Hand up if you enjoy and feel inspired when you go for a walk in the woods or you look out on the tree outside. Fantastic. Trees are really, really important. And one of the things that you might be interested in is a short documentary film that is showing this Wednesday here at St Mark's called Call of the Forest. And it's going to be very informative about why trees inspire and uplift us. It is also thinking about why trees are so important when we think about climate change. And we're showing it as part of our group called Zero Carbon Harrogate, which is trying to enact some of the hope that we've been hearing about and thinking about, just to use Anne's fabulous term, that abundance of generosity and thinking about a more positive way forward. And we're trying to work out as Zero Carbon Harrogate how we can transform the town into a sustainable low-carbon economy. So do come along this Wednesday if you'd like to know more about it, 7:30. And we're very fortunate we have Professor Piers Forster. If you look him up on the internet, you'll find out that he is, in fact, a Nobel Prize winner for his scientific work with climate change. And he's going to be talking about his local United Bank of Carbon, a tree twinning project, which... He's not a Christian, but he is just inspiring the way that God is at work here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jemima. Thank you. Have we got any comments, questions, reflections?
In tomorrow's lectionary readings, Isaiah urges us to beat our spears into pruning hooks and our swords into plowshares. Would I be going too far to think that what we have heard this morning is one way of doing that to prevent the causes of war within ourselves?
Thank you. Do you have a response?
Only to say, I think that's the insight that the Mennonites have won, that peace has to begin with ourselves, and that this perception that anxiety is that which disturbs our own peace and makes us more likely to lash out. I think if there's any youth workers here, the challenge of the youth worker is to help the youth to shift from that reptile reactive brain that can lash out to the more reflective, just cool it. And so that aspect of human nature, I think, is always with us. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Do talk between yourselves. And just
can I say thank you very much for a really inspiring talk, Anne? And could I ask you to say a little bit more about the practice of gratitude?
Oh, right. Well, if we do nothing else, I think it's Meister Eckhart who says that if the only prayer you ever say is thank you, it will be sufficient. And I think gratitude is one of those aspects of our human condition which cannot but do good. That we are now beyond the generation that does a kind of cheap courtesy. That the word thank you has been rescued from, a habit. So when we hear thank you, often it has been genuinely provoked. And of course, it's the, is it CBT? What's it stand for, Kurt? I think one of the first steps is to count five things that you're grateful for every night before you go to sleep. And of course, I can remember Miss Venables, my Sunday school teacher in Bootle, tutoring me and counting me blessings, name them one by one. The new insight is that when we count something, it gets located in a slightly different place in our complex brains, but it's next to the emotions, nearer to the emotions. So it actually, if I mix all my metaphors, kind of bathes the brain in a sense of the world is a positive, virtuous place. So the thanking really does seem to be a fundamental health-giving feature, almost like helps our immune system when we're struggling with resentments and fears and anxieties. So yeah, go for it. If thank you is the only prayer you ever make, it will be sufficient. Meister Eckhart, lovely that. Thanks for that question very much.
Thank you. I was just going to ask about humour and fun and laughter. Sometimes within churches, those sort of things tend to be frowned on or certainly kept at a certain level. And I always think it's very interesting that places that have been greatly deprived have often the greatest senses of humour, Merseyside being one of them. And I've been somebody who worked on Merseyside for 5 years. There's a humour and within the Scouser that is quite unique. And why do you think it is that we tend to look down on within worship and everything else the use of humour and laughter thing?
Can I start with the word worship, because I think I've never been able to get my head around it as a process or as a concept, worship, because it's something about giving God his worth, and we've decided somehow that it's best done as a corporate activity. The cynic in me says, yes, that's because you can then hand round the plate. So once we get institutions, you have to have something that brings us all together. And I've not quite escaped that rather dastardly thought and this suspicion about worship. Because I don't know whether it's theologically as robust a concept as we've come habitually to think it is. And what I do know is that for those who only half believe or have chaotic belief, then worship becomes an impossibility. So the notion that our public face as church is worship seems to me to really be prone to a lot of hazards. So I'm left thinking, well, where do we laugh? And we laugh at things like in messy church. We certainly, on Thursday, we're at the parish I go to, we're in a vacancy. And the people who have held morning prayer together at midday, so we just get in at morning, are people who are very, very vulnerable. But I'm even more vulnerable when I'm trying to find my place in that, I don't know, 800-page book, which counts as morning prayer. And of course, they laugh at me, because they know how to do it, because they come most mornings. And it felt as if that was a little glimpse, that rumour of angels. So there's something about not being able to do things as well as we would like to. And that makes the coming together of a large group so much more relaxed. The other feature is about self-deprecation, which is probably the safest way to be involved in humour, because it's saying, do you know what? I'm not all I'm made up to be. And there's something hugely honest about that. But the reason why humour's tricky is that it is also the beginning of exclusion. So to laugh at can be quite a dangerous process. So the stricture now against, say, Irish jokes, racist jokes, is a wise one, because to laugh at and to mock does take us onto quite a tricky slope. So humour is not straightforward. I like to see it in terms of self-forgetfulness. And if we bring self-forgetfulness into the context of worship, it's a very special moment.
I've loved every minute of your presentation, and as others have said, just like to thank you. But I'm intrigued by some of the things you've said about brain function and so on.
Oh, right.
And otherwise, perhaps I wouldn't dare ask this. But in our congregation, we have one person who, in the view of my wife anyway, who has spent many years working with people on Asperger's syndrome, on the spectrum, and autistic people, who is clearly in that place. And we have assumed it's because of that, perhaps, he does tend to lapse into some aspects of tribalism, so much so that when it comes to conversations, as it has recently, about the outcome of the European referendum and so on, he becomes, well, almost paranoid and becomes very difficult to engage with. Now, to what extent can, I'm not sure whether conditions is the right word, but those who may have that outlook, how can we relate to them along the lines that you, or relate more effectively with them along the lines that you've been describing, I wonder?
I certainly can't make any comment about the structure of our brain. In fact, sometimes, if I'm going to go off on that trope, I'll ask, are there anybody here who does brain imaging? And the scariest thing is when you get three hands. But I am told that my cartoon image will pass muster. I think it's something about our smaller groups, because I think all of us, in fact, it's a very interesting, where is she from? The Richard Charters, Bishop of London, who's very, very interested in climate change. And he suggests that we are autistic, all of us, in relation to the creation, because we have no sense of the impact and the cost that the world is incurring in our habits and our way of, and that we have no sense of that impact. So I think I'd be trying to make an effort of including autism as being my problem. In areas that, in the very nature of autism, I do not know. And of course that would work, that the reason why we need each other is actually to enlighten us about that side that we cannot perceive or anticipate within ourselves. And that would be small groups, the class. The class that has built trust because it's owned its wretchedness. Right, yeah. No, I wouldn't want to comment, and couldn't comment on a specific like that.
My question is, seeing that vulnerability is our natural state, the example you gave of the woman at the well, that Jesus was in need of water, yeah. And he came and he was in need. And trouble is, as trainee readers, is that you come to minister to someone, whether they want it or not, and it's, you have to learn to sort of...
You have to clothe that vulnerability, don't you?
It was only some years back when I'd cracked two ribs, and some people from the church, some ladies from the church came and looked after me, that I learnt to be weak occasionally, and it... opens up the door for you to minister to them and them to minister to you.
The way in which I pull the two together about vulnerability, and if you want differentials of vulnerability, because it'd be dishonest to say that, you know, we are all equally vulnerable. On one level, yes, but we have different competencies and aptitudes and opportunities. I use the term struggle. Lifting it from the way the black community will use the term struggle, which is to fight for insight, to kind of strip ourselves of commonsensical views which we take for granted. They use the expression, ideas that we absorb with our mother's milk. So struggle is about a way of seeing which is kind of far more radical than often church life permits. But the reason why I own struggle as such an important theological concept, in fact, some would say that that is the sin against the Holy Spirit, to desist from struggle, from insight, is that as a species, we've almost organized our lives to protect ourselves from struggle, that we've kind of embraced playpen living. So our biggest desire is to be comfortable and to be safe. Now, that's not just a spiritual disaster zone. It's also a disaster zone for a species. Because any species which ceases to rub up against the raw and abrasive aspects of life has entered an evolutionary cul-de-sac. Which is why I encourage those of us who have a comfortable life, and I include myself in it, to make sure that I am partaking of aspects of struggle. And there is so much grace around it, you know. I was going to start you off with the image from just up the road, you know, the calendar girls. Because that's a wonderful illustration of how one modicum bit of struggle, which was a lumpy settee in a hospital, starts to cascade into a whole bigger struggle and transformation. So I don't know, I can't remember what your question was, but I hope got off on one there.
Got a question here.
Thank you very much for probably, I think I will have lost count of the number of ideas and insights I've got from this morning.
Thank you.
I'll think of them in about a month's time. They'll dawn on me then. But I was interested in one thing that you said in referring to systems thinking or interrelatedness. And it sort of made me aware of the thing in the way that you presented it. There's also sort of two dangers lurking underneath that, in that, you know, what you were describing as new tribalism is one example, in a way, of interconnectedness revealing itself, because it's an assumption that because something can be correlated, it is therefore a cause. So it's, I feel like, a weak recognition of interconnectedness. And there is always that danger that we think, ah, yes, things are connected to one another, therefore, because people with blue jackets hog the microphone for 10 minutes, therefore everybody with a blue jacket is going to hog the microphone for 10 minutes. And I've seen some things from it. Bishop of Maidenhead made some comments about conservative theology this week that struck me as being an example of correlation being masquerading as causation. It isn't necessarily. And then the other thought that occurred to me was also, there is also that danger of assuming that chaos theory, the butterfly flapping its wings, means that something is good is going to happen if I do something in the corner over there. And I just wondered if actually what you were driving at was more think we need to be aware that our actions are connected to other actions and try to be the chess master, if you like, in thinking one or two steps ahead so that we can see that our actions will go in roughly the right direction, even if we can't completely direct them. So that we and also then to be aware of these other hidden dangers and not to just assume everything is going to be wonderful.
I hadn't gone in that direction, but thank you for that. I was simply saying, what I'm trying to do is to rehabilitate sin in the way in which we think of it, and certainly the wider world thinks of it. And that's my kind of commitment to mission, really, because, as I say, we'd never have a sense of needing a saviour if we don't have a pretty informed view of the nature of sin. The thing that I felt was significant in what I said was that idea that if you ask the question why five times, we are in some way implicated, because systems have this mysterious aspect to them. And it's family systems theory. And I always think it's got such a complicated name that it's worth unpacking. It uses the term family because it says that our ways of thinking and acting will often derive from our family or community of origin or congregation. So that's why the challenge is so often to our imagination. And when we say thinking outside the box, we're really saying I'm thinking outside the family of origin that has shaped me. So you've got families, systems, this idea that we are all part of a dynamic which is too big for us to unpick, really, which is why I'd perhaps say that to think of ourselves as chest masters might not be the best image. And then the theory for family systems theory is that all of us are organising our lives to try and lessen the impact that anxiety is having on us. So it would be without any shame saying those of us who are embracing a faith may well be following our family of origin, but we will also have opted in that direction because it seems to be a means of managing anxiety. Because one of the distinctive features of the species is that we are anxious. Hence, you know, Jesus coming as a babe being so significant. Family systems theorists would say, it's not a bad choice being religious. You know, it's not a bad choice. It seems to be a pretty health-giving way of coping with anxiety. So I don't know, there's a bit of a gap between us, but that's more out of my ignorance, I think, rather than, yeah.
I think we might have time just for one more. Anybody with not a blue coat?
There's a pink coat. Can you just remind us, Anne, about what you said at Scargill about people in church? Was it living longer or being less anxious or something like that?
It's very embarrassing in our secular world that when people do research in this realm called positive psychology, they, to their dismay, keep discovering that people who do business with God seem to have better scores in terms of positive psychology. And one of the latest, it was last summer, was some work about cheerfulness. And of course, cheerfulness is not really a theological category. We'd probably turn it into joy. Let's have a three-letter word again. That if you want to find where joy is, it seems to be more closely related to people who do business with God, more than, say, volunteering, and certainly more than volunteering for a political party. And of course, the researchers then say, we're not quite sure why this should be. And it is just repeated, this almost, it's a functional protector, really. But it does, I think, cause other secular minds to realise that on the public stage, this is the kind of evidence that has an influence. That those of us who are part of the remedial group may well have chosen well, if we're chosen at all, which is probably another subject for debate here.
Thank you, Anne. I think one of my insights of the morning is I love to think of myself as a very rational person. I love to think of faith as a process of reason. I love to think of our society and our politics as essentially rational. Actually, you know, maybe how we feel about things is something we need to put more thought. Mm. Is that tautologist? More no, thought into know. how we feel about things. It's been a really inspiring morning,
Thank
Anne.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you
so much for all you've offered us, and it's just been an absolute joy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you.